Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Shared Values edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm here to talk with Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
It says here you're a senior strategy officer at a political risk startup. This is something I've not seen on my piece of paper before.
It's been there for a while, yes.
Oh my God, I never even noticed that. This just goes to prove
Wait,
how
Anna,
much
did you get a job?
it's a job.
It's a job. She's doing air quotes.
There are big air quotes. There.
Okay, so anyway, welcome Anna, who's a... Well, she's senior, which is good. And welcome to Jordan Weissman, who's also senior. You're a senior something-something at Slate.
Yes. Blah, 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 blah.
And, and we are going to actually do something which we pride ourselves on generally not doing, which is talking about the stock market.
We do it once in a while.
And once in a while is more or less the correct frequency to check in on the stock market.
Especially the Dow.
Yeah. It's like a pet you don't have to mind too much.
Right.
It's like a lizard of some sort or something.
If, you know, there are certain radio shows which pride themselves on doing the numbers every single day and telling you what the stock market did this day compared to where it closed the previous day. That is stupid. Don't do that. Pay no attention to that.
Do not subtweet. You know, I'm going to leave that alone. Just go ahead.
On the other hand, like paying no attention to the stock market whatsoever is your, if you do that, then you're missing out on an important data point. So every so often, it's worth checking in on how it's doing. Mm-hmm. We are now 6 months into the Trump presidency. We are hitting all-time highs on virtually every index.
It's roaring.
Yep.
And and Trump, of course, is taking great credit for this, which I feel is unbelievably stupid because when it falls, you know, he's going to have to own it.
Also, during the campaign, he specifically called it a bubble.
Did he? I forgot.
Yes, he did.
That's right. Yeah, but now he wants to keep the interest rates low.
Exactly.
So
he's a low-interest rate kind of guy.
But both Trump and Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary, are on the record saying, yes, the level of the stock market is basically...
He called it a report card. Mnuchin.
Report card. Yeah.
He said,
somebody else's report card.
Right.
So right now, the stock market index that the press cares about more than any other is this ridiculous thing, which isn't even an index, called the Dow.
Okay, we've talked about it. It is an index. It's just not an index in the way that you...
It is a price-weighted index.
Yes.
And that is stupid.
Yeah. Okay, yes.
It's an average. It's an average, not an index.
It is. We all agree. We all agree it's stupid. I think you're...
And this is why when a stock like Boeing, which is expensive, has a movement, it is a disproportionate movement in the Dow.
In any case, it doesn't really matter because whether you're looking at the Dow or whether you're looking at the S&P 500 or whether you're looking at the Russell 5000, everything is hitting all-time highs. And so the question, Anna Szymanski, is, does this mean that America is great again?
No, I think this means that interest rates continue to be low.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that, yes, it's also because earnings have been robust. And especially if you look at how multinationals are doing and companies that make a lot of revenues overseas are doing disproportionately well. And they also tend to have bigger weight in the different indices. So that's another big part of this.
So, you know, what's going on reminds me of is... Britain right after Brexit,
and you're absolutely right, a fascinating comparison because everyone expected the stock market to fall and it didn't, and the reason in both cases of what the stock market has done in 2017 in the US and also what the stock market did after Brexit, you know, 6 months earlier in the UK, is in both cases, there's a very large component of currency weakness priced into the stocks.
It's and what I guess the key thing for listeners is the dollar's been crashing. Like the dollar's at a 15-month low. Right after Trump was elected, the dollar shot up because I think this is a case where the narrative was pretty clear, where people expected a lot of spending, interest rates to rise. And when interest rates rise, the value of the dollar goes up because it attracts investment. That didn't really happen. And now people are seeing, oh, shit, Donald Trump can't pass jack through Congress. Right. And so they don't expect that kind of boost in spending. And they're not so sure the Fed's going to increase interest rates anymore because they've been a little bit more hesitant, or they're not going to increase them at the pace, at least, that they expected. So the dollar's been crashing. And then that leads to, like Felix was saying, currency weakness. And so you get this effect where, you know, foreign multinationals that make profits abroad look great because the dollar's weaker.
Okay, so can I just step in here and say this is making no sense to me.
What?
You can't say that the stock market rises in November and December because the dollar is strong and then it rises in 2017.
It didn't rise because the dollar was strong.
Weak. No.
The reason the stock market rose, again, there are multiple reasons why the stock market rose. I actually think ultimately the expectation of low rates is continuing to be the main story behind all of this. But yes, there was probably a little bit after Donald Trump where there was an expectation of lower taxes, less regulation, increased deficit spending, which could, though, also in the short term lead to increased GDP growth. But I think ultimately it had to do with higher earnings.
Yeah.
Again, it had to do. And then I think now that the expectation is that rates are going to stay lower for longer, that we're in this Goldilocks moment where we're growing fast enough that earnings are doing well, but we're not growing so fast that rates are going to increase at an increased pace.
And when I'm saying that the dollar contributes, I was just sort of echoing your point, which is at this moment now, you have the weak dollars contributing to those profits.
Especially, so. I mean, you have companies that, if potentially you're making a lot of your revenues in foreign currency and you're making a lot of your costs are potentially in dollars, then that relative value shift you're going to benefit from.
I also, the other thing about this that, and maybe Felix is going to roll his eyes after I make this point, but I'm going to risk it anyway. What I think we're seeing right now, which is kind of interesting, is that the U.S. economy, which, I mean, job growth is going pretty well. GDP is okay. The stock market is, of course, booming. The economy, finance, the markets can kind of soldier on in a country, even if like civil society is like rapidly deteriorating. That's like the fascinating thing to me about this is like shit's actually really, really bad politically. And yet the country's kind of soldiering on, which I don't know if that's encouraging or discouraging.
And certainly if you look at the latest jobs report, we have unemployment at 4.3% now.
Yeah.
Things are looking up. And the other thing is, to your point about, I mean, I wouldn't say that the dollar has been crashing. I think the dollar is still plenty strong. I think it was extremely unsustainably strong.
So it's coming to earth.
Yeah,
is more like,
and it's kind of weakened back a bit to a strong but not crazy strong level. Certainly, it has room to continue to weaken.
Yes.
You know, by historical standards, it's looking very strong. But coming back to the original question, there are two metrics by which the market based individuals like to judge, well, three metrics by which market-based individuals love to judge how an economy is doing. One is long-term interest rates, one is the level of the stock market, and one is the currency. Right now, if you look at those three metrics in the U.S., the stock market is doing great. The currency, as you say, is not doing as well. It's come down, but it's still doing reasonably well. It's still a reasonably strong currency.
Right.
And if you listen to any Treasury secretary over the past 50 years, they'll say a strong dollar is in the national interest, even though no one really knows what that means. And then the last one is long-term interest rates, which are now, what, like low twos, or like 2.2%, something like that. Again, that looks pretty healthy to me. Like, if you look at the report card across all three asset classes, U.S. is doing okay.
I'm going to push back a little bit, though, that I think, again, a lot of this right now is also you just have a lot of money chasing returns.
Yeah.
When rates are very low, rates on high-grade bonds are also fairly low, you then have more and more people going into equities. And then we can get into this later when we talk more about index funds, but just pushing up values to, in my mind, unsustainable levels, and also paying more for risk at a period when the potential for return is the lowest it's ever been.
Okay, I would also add to that, the reason for the low rates you have to keep in mind is that, you know, we can't seem to hit our inflation target. We can't, like, no matter what, we are undershooting inflation. And that speaks to some sort of weakness somewhere, whether it's just the fact that we actually are not close to full employment, even though we have a low unemployment rate. There are just too many people sitting on the sidelines of the job market. Whatever it is, it's just like it seems like there is some fundamental fragility that's keeping
so
us.
So I want to just end here because Anna's talked about low rates a long time. Like, if we talk about... I want to just end here because Anna's talked about low rates a few times here. When you're talking about stocks in particular, the discount rate you apply to stocks, which are permanent capital, is like a long-term discount rate, not an overnight discount rate.
No. I mean, it's a very different if your terms of your, like, if you're discounting like cash flows to value equities, that's different. But if you're, again, it's all relative. So if you have a lot of money going into bonds to keep those rates lower, that's then going to keep all, again, essentially rates lower.
So I just want to come back to these low interest rates because Anna's been talking about low interest rates a lot. Are they really that low? I mean, I was saying that, you know, the long rates are, what, 2.2-ish? Short rates, you know, as set by the Fed, are coming up. They are low by historical standards, but they are definitely higher than they were. I mean, how low?
We've had essentially practically zero, almost negative interest rates for close to 10 years. This is not normal. And this keeps all rates low. Because if you're thinking of, like, how do you figure out your cost of equity? Well, that's going to be based essentially on the risk-free rate and then, you know, beta times your equity premium. So if the risk-free rate, your like 10-year, is low, that's going to keep all rates low.
So I guess what I'm asking you is, what do you consider to be low for the 10-year? What do you consider to be a reasonable, normal, long-term rate for the 10-year, and what would you consider to be high for the 10-year?
I mean, I would say, like, essentially where we are right now, if you figure where inflation is, you have rates, again, very close to zero. That's
so
quite
real
low.
Rates. So basically, the nominal rate, which we were saying was about 2.2, minus inflation, which is probably around, what, 1.7. So that's like about 0.5% in terms of a real rate on the 10-year. You're saying that's low.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of exactly where the rates to be, I don't know exactly what number you want to go for, but definitely if you look historically, these rates are not normal.
So at what point, I guess I'm asking, like, at what point would real rates need to go to for you to stop saying that?
I mean, at least probably getting closer to, what, between 3-5%, like just something a little bit more normal.
3-5% real rates.
Yes, I'm not going to come down an exact number of exactly where rates should be, but I do think that rates need to be probably a few hundred basis points higher to really reflect, I think I would argue, like, actual risk.
So instead of the 10-year treasury having an interest rate of 2%, it would be like 5 or 6%.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a rather terrifying prospect for anyone who owns bonds, but we will come to that probably at some point in the next decade or two. This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet, and it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. I do want to stick, though, with the stock market, because something really interesting happened this week. We have talked over and over and over again on this show about the wonders of passive investing and how you shouldn't try to beat the market and it's a waste of time and you should just put your money in an index fund. But now, Anna, there seems to be a difference, at least going forwards, between what an index fund holds and what the market as a whole is.
Yes. And also, I'm just going to come out here as someone who does not actually believe that passive investment is all that it's cracked up to be and could potentially be a problem for the overall market, which we can get into. But yes, so S&P and Russell have both announced that most of their indexes will no longer include companies that have multiple share classes.
And a multiple share class company, and we're used to this in the media world from places like News Corp and in the technology world from places like Google.
Doesn't the New York Times have multiple
Most family-owned companies, or most companies where you have family control or founder control, but the founders have an economic interest of less than 50%, which is a lot of companies, you'll find these. Facebook has it, Google has it, Viacom has it, you name it, they all have it. But now, the indexers, S&P most prominent among them, have come out and said, buster, this is ridiculous. And if you come to market from this point forwards with multiple share classes where a handful of insiders control the company despite owning a minority of the stock, we are not going to include you in the index.
Yeah, and I think we could ultimately call this like the Snap decision. This is, I'm not saying it's just about Snap, but clearly that's a big part of this.
So what did Snap do?
I mean, they issued shares that had zero voting rights.
Yeah.
And that is, the fact that investors went along with that shows you how degraded investment standards have become, because it doesn't make any sense, unless, frankly, you think you can just buy the share and flip it to an index fund. It doesn't make any sense why you are going to give money to a company and then have zero rights, that you are, in a sense, a partial owner, but have zero rights.
Well, maybe it's just because shareholders don't feel that they have much in the way of voting power anyway, or that the way to affect change at a company is not necessarily through formal voting. As we saw at Uber, you can defenestrate a CEO even if he has control.
Right, but that's also, they weren't publicly traded. I mean, I think it's still the idea that if you're talking about a publicly traded company, the best way to affect change is going to be having some type of, you know, proxy battle, or, you know, putting pressure on the owners, the shareholders, holding them accountable.
So there are two different possible outcomes here. As, you know, the parade of unicorns waits to go public, and some of them at some point surely will. One possible outcome is that these unicorns are going to take one look at this determination by S&P and say, okay, I mean, part of going public is to become part of the index, and so we are going to have to make sure we only have one share class where we go when we go public. The other possible outcome is that the unicorns are going to continue to have multiple share classes, and there will be an increasing divergence between what the indexes contain and what the stock market as a whole contains.
Right. And I think that is, well, that's important for a few reasons. A, because I think sometimes people think an index is the market, and an index is almost never the market. These are two different things. The S&P has always had restrictions on what it includes.
My favorite example today is Tesla. Tesla is one of those stocks which has been going through the roof, and one would think that if you had an S&P 500 index fund, given how much Tesla is worth, then some, maybe like 1/500th or so of your index fund would be in Tesla, and you would be getting the benefit of that share price appreciation. Not so.
Why is it not?
Tesla is not in the S&P 500 because it basically doesn't make money.
Ah. So my question is, why is S&P... why do they care so much? Why
because
is this,
this
their,
is
why
a is, big deal in terms of shareholders not having rights. Yes, it is. This is a big corporate governance issue. And if you start to have more and more companies issuing shares where you don't have, like, that is, I would argue, leading to the road to disaster where founders and owners are not being held accountable.
Is that S&P's job, really, to be like the corporate governance enforcers?
And the answer
if investors aren't?
Yeah, well, the answer is yes.
Okay.
I think the interesting, and it's interesting why the answer is yes. The answer is yes for two reasons. One is the rise of passive investing means that ultimately these decisions have to be made by the indexes because no one else is making them.
Okay.
And as I say, like, the indexes have always made these decisions. Making these decisions is nothing new. S&P's put in these rules about profitability, which excluded Tesla. Those have been there for a while. The almost like papal secrecy surrounding like which companies wind up in the Dow is, you know, a very fraught and highly political decision. I remember when, you know, the Dow expanded to include companies which were listed on the NASDAQ and not on the NYSE. It was like a huge thing, right?
Yeah.
And so, and you know, one of the reasons that Apple finally split its shares was so that it could enter the Dow. There were all manner of, you know, decision-making about what goes into indexes and what doesn't. And the indexes have always made these decisions. And as Anna says, what we saw with Snap was not just, I mean, we saw with Google and its C-shares and with Under Armour earlier, companies which had gone public with a dual-class share system, then issuing a new class of non-voting shares with zero votes, which a lot of people were up in arms and about and said, you can't do that. But it was kind of ex post. It was too late to do anything about it at that point.
Yep.
Snap actually went public with this. And everyone was like, this is just beyond the pale. We have to draw the line somewhere. And this is where we're drawing the line. The interesting thing is going to be that, and what I'm unclear about, Anna, maybe you can help clear this up, is will S&P evict existing companies?
No, they're grandfathering.
They're grandfathered in if they have dual share classes right now. But if they create a new share class going forwards, is that enough to get kicked out?
I haven't heard, but my guess is yes, especially because I know Russell has been allowing like companies that already have certain that are included but have those additional share classes, they within 5 years have to essentially change that in order to remain included. So my guess is, again, I don't know exactly, but I think that they could potentially be kicked out.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So this is actually a perfect segue.
Okay. Here we go.
This is a great segue to the question of whether a public company can be a B corporation, can be a benefit corporation.
Or should it just be a crunchy ass co-op and, you know, feed its soul that way? Anyway.
So we're going to spend a little bit of time here talking about one of my favorite, most interesting companies, which is Etsy.
Yes.
Etsy is, you know, it's a genuine unicorn which went public on the stock market and it was valued at $3 billion. And I should imagine, given the demographics of podcasting, that many of our listeners have bought something from Etsy at some point.
Most I have likely. Become. I never have.
I have become something of an Etsy Ninja? Aficionado. You know, I have weird idiosyncrasies, among them a taste for 100% cotton socks. And it turns out to be basically impossible to get 100% cotton socks in the United States. And there's this very friendly chap in Turkey called All Socks Seller in Turkey who sells 100% cotton socks. And that's where I get my socks now.
Lovely.
Yeah. And he's on Etsy.
Lovely.
I bought some lovely mittens on Etsy.
I feel like everything you buy on Etsy can be described as lovely.
Yeah. Anyway, I like Etsy. I've bought some wonderful funny needle points on Etsy, which I love, and I have some bedside lights, which
I love. We're just learning more and more.
Etsy is a great company, but here's the thing about Etsy. It was always founded with this idea that it was going to be a B corporation.
Yeah.
And a B Corp, a benefit corp, is one which doesn't only answer to its shareholders.
The dual bottom line, right?
Or as many different
bottom
lines. As many different bottom lines as you want. Basically, it's accountable to its employees, to its various stakeholders, to its customers, to the planet. You know, it tries to.
Gaia.
Anyway, go on, Felix.
And this is and this actually works in a practical sense. There are lots of companies which do this. Patagonia has been around for a long time. Yep. It's been
private companies that do this.
Yes,
right. And Etsy was obviously before it went public. It was private, and it was a successful private B Corp. And what everyone always wanted to know was, okay, like if you own your own family-owned company or, you know, tightly held company, and you want to run it however you want to run it, you can run it any way you like. Does that work in the world of, you know, cutthroat public stocks? Yeah. And Etsy basically said, you know what, it can. And B Lab, which is the official organization which basically says, yes, you qualify to be a B Corp or not, was also very keen on the idea that, yes, you can. And Etsy was the test case. And the way it works is, and there is actually a legal way of doing this and under Delaware law, is that you register under Delaware law as being a public benefit corporation. And what B Lab says is that, you know, it has a whole bunch of criteria which you need to meet to be a B Corp.
But you register in Delaware, so you don't have to pay taxes.
Well, yeah.
Well, no,
you're accountable to Gaia, but not to the IRS.
No, this is not true at all. This is absolutely not true, okay. Because one of the big fights over Etsy was about how it pays taxes.
Oh, interesting.
And Etsy and B Lab had big fights with Etsy about saying, like, you are doing a bunch of stuff which looks like tax avoidance to us, and tax avoidance is not cool. And Etsy actually changed the way it paid taxes and is now paying more taxes. And it managed to raise its score from B Lab from 80, which was just the minimum needed to be a B Corp, up to like 120 because it's paying more taxes.
Nice. Okay.
So like, taxes is definitely part of this. And there's a bunch of different, you know, ingredients to this pie. But the most crucial thing, once you're a public company, you do need to become a public benefit corporation. That's a necessary condition. And Etsy did not meet that necessary condition when it went public. And it was never entirely obvious when or whether it would become a public benefit corporation. And it kept on saying, yeah, kind of like, you know, we'd like to probably in the future, perhaps. And B Lab, which really wants public B Corps out there, you know, this is, it would be great if you could have public B Corps, kept on like pushing back the deadline and saying, yeah, honestly, like, we'll give you a little bit more time if you need it, but we want you to go there. And then in May, there was this boardroom coup. So Chad Dixon, who was the founder and CEO, got kicked out. He was the, you know, the big evangelist for benefit corporations. This new guy, Josh Silverman, comes in. It becomes more and more obvious that Etsy is not going to become a public benefit corporation. And guess what? The share price starts going up. This is the problem. Like, I feel like, so what happened?
Well, there's also talk about possibly selling the company too.
There's talk about a number of things.
Yeah. So basically what has happened since May is that all of the crunchiness of Etsy has pretty much gone out the window.
It's pretty crunchy.
They've brushed away most of the granola.
They've managed to fire like 22% of their staff. They have started talking very openly about selling to strategic acquirers. They started making money. They just released second quarter earnings where they actually made a profit of $11 million.
Yeah.
And that sent their stock up another 10%. So the stock is probably a good, like, it's gone up from like $11 to $15 since the CEO came in just a few months. That's like 40%, and that's impressive.
And
now they're looking and feeling like a retailer. Like, they used to hand crunch their own code. They were very proud.
Which was a horrible idea.
They were very proud of the fact that all of their technology was developed in-house. And then the new CEO comes and goes, like, why are we developing all of this technology in-house? We're selling knitted hats on the internet. Well, we can just buy technology off the shelf, which will work better.
Well, doesn't that come back to the whole song and dance you have to do in Silicon Valley, which is you have to be a tech company. You can't be a retailer.
Which is what they are.
You can't be a juice maker. Right. You have to be you have to have some sort of technological component. So I'm sure that helped them early on in terms of just, you know, attracting investment, and then it outlived its usefulness, right?
And also because they used to have higher revenue growth and now they don't. And I if you're looking at how you value a stock, you're going to be looking at future cash flows. And if you're looking at this type of company that has a niche market, I know that the new CEO, you know, said yesterday, like, you know, we're special, but the market for special is huge. And I'm like, no, the market for normal is huge. The market for special by definition is small.
But the long tail, Anna. The long tail. Sorry.
So I think that this company, I don't think their original stock price was ever fully justified, because I don't see how you project that type of growth. They were spending like a tech company. They were, in some sense, at a certain point, being valued like a tech company, but they don't have the growth potential of a tech company.
So is this like, is this the story of a failure of like the B Corp idea, or is this just the story of like the failure of crunchy Etsy? Or is it both?
I think it's both. Although I really don't think the B Corp model is ever going to work for publicly traded companies. I think B Corps for private companies it's a nice marketing tool. I think that it's great to call attention to things. I think if you're talking about a publicly traded company, you are going to be less profitable almost certainly by doing this. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't encourage companies to engage in more environmentally sustainable practices, better labor practices? Yes, that is the role of government. That is not the role of companies to, in some sense, have to govern like themselves. And the reality
is, why can't they? I mean,
because you're not going to be more profitable. You're just not.
No, but Anna, that's okay. This is like, if I come out as a B Corp and I say I am not mainly interested in profits, I'm interested in many things of which profits are just one, and I go public on that understanding, and I'm going to say that at the margin, yes, I am going to care about making sure that all of my employees have health insurance rather than maximizing profits. I'm going to care about the planet rather than maximizing profits. That I can be a publicly traded company and you can discount my cash flows on the basis that I might be less profitable, but you can still trade my stock. There's no reason why I can't issue stock on that basis. Why does a public company always need to be maximizing profits?
Because you are taking shareholder money.
Yeah.
And so I would argue that the role of a CEO, I think when people talk about shareholder value, it is often the term is misused. And actually, I think a lot of CEOs misuse it. And they think it's this idea of maximizing short-term profits to try to get like a boost in your share price, which is not what shareholder value means. It means allocating capital efficiently with an eye towards long-term growth, long-term objectives, and long-term future cash flows. Because here's my argument. Like, if you're like, what are the components of a DCF model? Your future cash flows. And that is what is going into, in theory, what your share price should be. Now, if your future cash flows are, in theory, going to be getting smaller and smaller, how your value of your share price is going to be quite low. And also, you have taken money from the public. So now you, I think, do have a, in some sense, duty to give them a certain return. And if you want to engage in some of these practices, that's great. But then I don't know if you should be a publicly traded company.
Okay, and I just guess deeply, deeply disagree with this. Because if I take money from the public while explicitly saying that I am not going to be trying to maximize profits at every available expense, and they give me money on those terms with their eyes open, then that's a transaction between consenting adults.
Fine. And then the other reality is what's going to happen is then the value of your share price is going to decline and decline and decline.
Okay.
Well, so I guess I kind of want to split that.
Because then the value of your company is declining.
And what's wrong with that?
I want to,
because then you're going to go out of business.
No, that doesn't mean that at all.
I want to split the baby here, or attempt to. First off, I guess one of the issues here, again, is like you said, Felix, is Etsy failed to go public as a public benefit corporation. That is one of the issues, is that they didn't do this properly. But I wonder if there's sort of an inevitability to how these kind of failures might unfold, right? Like, if you do go public as a benefits corporation and your stock does trade at that discount, I have to think there will just be someone out there, some activist investors looking at your stock and licking their chops and saying, you know, if we could get them to be a little less good, we could get them to make profits. If we could like buy their stock and just push them to be a little bit more ruthless capitalists, they can event. We could make a mint here. And I just wonder if that's sort of
so. This is my view. I think that there is this obsession in the public stock markets with growth.
Yeah.
If you look at the longest lived companies in the world, the ones which have lasted for hundreds of years, or in some cases in Japan and Italy over 1,000 years, all of them, without exception, are private. Everything from vineyards in Italy to hotels in Japan and Kikkoman soy sauce and all of these different companies. Yeah. And the reason that that private companies can last so long and do very well by their employees and by their owners, who are generally families, for many, many centuries, is precisely that they don't feel the need to grow the whole time. And people like Anna come along at public and look at public stocks and say, well, where's your revenue growth? Why aren't you growing? If you're not growing, then my DCF model doesn't work. And
well, it quite literally doesn't.
and that doesn't mean that a company can't work without growing. It really can work without growing, but the stock market, it doesn't like companies which don't grow.
Well, exactly. And so that's why I wonder if this is sort of inevitable. It's like, once you've decided to go public, even if you do have multiple bottom lines and you try to set up this kind of legal apparatus to protect the heart and soul of your company, I wonder if just eventually some, you know, Carl Icahn's going to come along essentially and turn you evil.
Two things. Yeah. I mean, like, okay, A, I still am going to push back on the idea that you can just not grow as a company and you're still going to be long-term profitability in the modern market. I just think that that's very difficult. Unless you're a small company that doesn't have a lot of scale, then okay.
Kikkoman soy sauce. I bring it back up. It doesn't grow a lot.
Okay, this is...
Kikkoman's, and they're everywhere.
Yeah.
They are everywhere.
It's also one company, and I've not looked at that company's financials. So I can't make a very intelligent...
You haven't looked at the financials because the financials aren't there.
Yes,
company.
I realize this. So, but I would also, going back a little bit, this is also... when we're talking about the standards that companies have to abide by. And again, I would argue that part of the reason that you are going to essentially be hampering yourself by being a B Corp on the public markets. Now, this is why I think that these standards are not things that should be set by this kind of somewhat arbitrary designation. These are issues that are this is the role of government. The government is supposed to set regulations. That is what government is supposed to do. Companies are supposed to make money. That's what they're supposed to do.
That's not true.
Yes. My point is that when you say okay, we're going to have a certain amount of ethical companies and they're, by being ethical, going to probably be less profitable. We're not going to put pressure on government to set regulations so we have a more level playing field.
No one's saying that. That's a straw man, Anna. No one's saying that we're not putting pressure on government.
But my point is, by saying that we need to make, we should focus more on the B Corp model, which is essentially companies having to set these regulations for themselves, as opposed to trying to create a more level playing field, I just think that I don't see the one model ever working.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we will leave it there and move on to a numbers round, why not?
Yeah, sure. I've got a number.
What's your number?
100,000, roughly.
Yeah, 100,000, roughly?
A little bit under. That was how it was reported. Apparently, Columbia Journalism School is starting a data journalism degree, a master's in data journalism, and the tuition is going to be $100,000. And I just want to say, because I think there's an off chance, Kathy O'Neill used to obviously be part of Columbia, and she taught the predecessor to this program that they're now creating. I just want to say, in case anybody at Columbia Journalism School is listening right now, that's fucking unconscionable. And it is absolutely grotesque that you are actually creating a $100,000 master's degree for anybody going into journalism. You can just...
Let alone the poor data... I have worked with many great data journalists, yeah, and they're awesome people, but I can tell you this is not a lucrative profession.
No, it is not. And it's also a very... It's a profession that's totally in flux. So, I mean, maybe you're teaching long-term skills that are going to be useful in 5 to 10 years. Maybe you're not. I really don't know. But either way, it's just... No. What are you? Where? How did this decision get made? Like, yes, so. it's just grotesque. And I said this on Twitter, and I'll say it again. I sincerely hope that CUNY, which I think is very good about charging very little for its grad programs, comes in, replicates your program, and charges maybe 1/5 to 1/6 of the price, because that's what they already do with journalism.
I agree.
Degrees.
The CUNY system is wonderful.
My number is 81 million, because in this wonderful frothy world of low discount rates and high asset prices, I feel like the counterexample is always a good one. 81 million is the discount that Howard Lutnick got when he bought his new condo in the Pierre Hotel. Actually, I think it's a co-op. Anyway, he bought a new apartment, the penthouse of the Pierre Hotel on Central Park with amazing views over Central Park. He paid $44 million for this penthouse, which is undoubtedly a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
But this is down $81 million from the original $125 million asking price.
I feel like this is a theme you have on some of these numbers.
It's true.
The high-end New York real estate market is...
Yeah.
Why did the asking price come down so much? Like, what was wrong with this penthouse?
And the penthouse is a very nice penthouse.
Did it need like a revamp, like a gut reno?
But
like...
the ultra-luxury end of the market has been flooded.
Interesting. And yet... it's going to be flooded more because they're rezoning large sections of Midtown to build more of this shit.
Although I actually think that's not a bad idea. But we can go into that later.
Yeah, more density is good. Anna, what's your number?
So my number is 12%. I have a kind of complicated number. So I thought this was going to be a very simple, nice feminist story. But it turns out it's more complicated. So a few weeks ago, I'd mentioned that in India, they've implemented this goods and services tax, which is a big deal. Now, there's been a bit of a row because sanitary napkins are being taxed at 12%. And there are a lot of other products like condoms that are being taxed at lower rates. So people were saying this seemed like a simple story of, you know, women are being taxed for being women. Then I did a little bit more research into it. And it turns out that part of the reason for that is because a lot of the inputs that go into this product are being taxed at a higher rate. And because this is a goods and services tax, I won't go into all the details of it, although goods and services tax are actually fascinating, so I highly recommend looking into them. But suffice it to say, if you are a domestic manufacturer, you are going to be at a significant disadvantage to foreign manufacturers. So again, it's a much more complicated issue. And even though I still very much support the women, I very much support them bringing interest to this issue, it's one of these instances where I think it's very important to look at all of the economics of any issue if you're trying to create change.
On which note, I think we're going to bring this edition of Slate Money to a close. Let us know if you think that B Corps are wonderful things and that you would happily spend more to support them because they're crunchy and delicious. Email us on slatemoney@slate.com. Let us know if you made the Tata de Santiago.
Yeah, I just want to say props to, I forget who it was who actually made the tarta and then emblazoned the Slate Money logo on the top of it, but you get like serious fan points for that.
Yep.
It's the cake which has made its way around the world. You can still get the recipe by emailing us. I also threw it up on felix.kinja.com in case you want to see it there.
Also fairly sure that every one of our listeners has already emailed asking for the recipe. You may have all done it. Our inbox has been flooded.
It's amazing.
It is just one, like, there have been points where my entire Gmail screen was just
torta. Yes.
And one delete my account.
Yeah, okay. I don't think we were coming out as anti-vegan in that rant.
No, I want to say, like, I was specifically saying alpha male vegans. This is a specific type of vegan.
Yes.
My best friend is a vegan.
But this show should be a safe space for all vegans.
No, it's true. No, but so one listener got very upset and thought that we were coming out as anti-vegans and asked to cancel their Slate Plus account. And we do want to emphasize, we are fine with veganism.
You're fine with it. I mean, I'm not coming out on this as a fine with veganism.
I think it is a wonderful moral stand to take. I am personally incapable of doing it, as I learned during my abortive effort at trying it for a month. However, we don't want to chase you away. We love what you're doing.
Just
for the world.
But we're sad that you won't get to experience the deliciousness that is Tarta de Santiago. In any case, if you want something to listen to while eating your Tarta de Santiago, then listen to Hit Parade, which is hosted by Chris Malanfi. This is a new Panoply podcast about what makes a song a smash. Chris is a really interesting guy who probably has listened to more top hit singles than anyone else in the United States. And I'm really kind of excited that this has finally become a podcast of its own. So check that out wherever you get your podcasts or at slate.com/hitparade. Many thanks to Dan Schrader. And I think that's it. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.